Hello, welcome to The Wire, where fresh coverage of independent news and current affairs from right around Australia comes to you on your local community radio station. I'm Roderick Chambers in Sydney, and coming up on the program today...
So the argument is that this makes eviction a lot easier and also, in a sense, undermines the scrapping of the no-grounds eviction.
New South Wales landlords can now renovict tenants under a loophole in the Minns government's no-grounds evictions legislation. We find out a bit more about it and will it affect you? Stay tuned for all of this and more coming up on The Wire. In an escalation of the war of words between Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and Prime Minister Albanese over the proposed recognition of a Palestinian state, Home Affairs Minister Tony Burke has refused Israeli government member Simcha Rothman a visa. This is what he said today on ABC Radio.
If someone is coming for the purpose of making public statements, and I don't obviously get notice personally of every individual, but where myself or my delegates are aware of previous public statements that person's made, then we have to work on the basis that that may well be part of their public speaking tour.
Tony Burke says that apart from his visa refusals for Candace Owens and Kanye West, he has refused two Israeli government members' visas, including Simcha Rothman.
There are two Israeli politicians, one former minister, Eilat Shaked, and then this individual, Mr. Rothman, who are a current sitting member, not a minister, but a member of the Knesset. They've both had similar comments, which I find horrific. This gentleman has described Palestinian children as the enemy.
Meanwhile, at a press conference today, Susan Lee, Leader of the Opposition, was asked that if she didn't agree with the visa cancellation, how would she have dealt with the contentious comments made by Mr. Rothman?
The point I make is that the issuing of a visa is not connected to the things people say, and comments that are reprehensible may well have been made. I haven't looked at the comments this individual has made, but what I would say is that not issuing a visa to an elected representative from a parliament of another country is something that the Home Affairs Minister needs to be very strong in his explanations for.
I asked Susan Lee that if we recognise Palestine, who should Australia be dealing with and what borders would the state have?
Well, that's a question that jumps forward to the end of the peace process, where those issues can be resolved. And I want to see that just like every Australian. I want to see that two-state solution. My criticism of the government is that they have gone ahead with a unilateral recognition of the state of Palestine without these issues being resolved in an unconditional way, with a terrorist group, Hamas, in charge, with conditions that seem to me, to be honest, to be quite impossible to meet. Hence the remarks that we made. We want to see a proper peace process. Recognition comes at the end of the peace process.
I'm Roderick Chambers, and it was Susan Lee, Leader of the Opposition, ending that report.
Hey there, we're the Warren Miller Band, and you're listening to The Wire on community and Indigenous radio across Australia.
Australian flag carrier Qantas has been issued with a $90 million fine by the federal court for illegally terminating and outsourcing over 1,800 ground staff during the pandemic. This is in addition to $120 million in compensation that the airline has already agreed to pay former employees. The fine is the largest employer penalty under the Fair Work Act on record. Maeve Groom asked Professor of Labour Law at the University of Sydney, Shay McChrystal, why Qantas was initially taken to court by the Transport Workers Union.
The TWU took Qantas to court because it argued that when Qantas made the decision to outsource ground handling services at 10 airports and make the workers, which was 1,820 workers, redundant, that it took that decision for a prohibited reason under the Fair Work Act. And you can't take a decision that impacts an employee adversely for a prohibited reason. And they said that the prohibited reason that Qantas acted for was that those workers were shortly about to have the ability to engage in collective bargaining and protected strike action.
Will this just be a corporate penalty for Qantas, or is there some form of direct compensation to the affected employees?
The fine is the last step in the proceedings. The compensation matter was handled last year. The amount of compensation that should be paid to the employees, because it was eventually determined through long court action that Qantas had been unable to show that it had not acted for that prohibited reason. Because they had taken that step, they had treated those workers in a way that disadvantaged them for a reason that was prohibited, they were entitled to be compensated for the economic and non-economic loss that they experienced as a consequence of that. And so Qantas agreed last year to pay $120 million into a compensation fund. What we saw yesterday was a fine for breaking the Fair Work Act, and that's a penalty payment.
What message does this fine send to the Qantas company itself? They have issued a formal apology for their conduct. However, many feel this to be insincere and not actually acknowledging the impact on the workers themselves that were terminated.
Qantas fought the litigation extremely hard. They appealed it all the way up to the High Court. And at various times in that process, they had a very vigorous PR strategy in which they continued to assert at all stages of the litigation that they had not acted unlawfully. So what's very interesting about Justice Lee's penalty decision is it's clear that he was not convinced that Qantas had displayed what would be an appropriate amount of remorse for their conduct. And he was critical of their public relations campaign, particularly where they were coming to the press after judgments without even having had sufficient time to read those judgments. And I think that this didn't help Qantas, because when they then finally are at the penalty hearing and they're at a point where they need to express remorse, because remorse and what you have learned are relevant to penalty, this made it difficult for them to establish that genuine remorse.
Define penalties of this scale genuinely deter huge corporations such as Qantas from breaking the law, or is it just seen as the cost of doing business if the rewards, so to speak, outweigh the risks of being caught?
I mean, that to my mind is the big question we have to grapple with in the wake of this fine. This is the biggest fine for breach of the Fair Work Act on record, so it's very substantial. However, if we look at Qantas's own statements, they claimed that they were going to save around $100 million a year through the decision to outsource these workers. So if you combine the cost of the compensation with the penalty cost and the millions of dollars they would have spent in legal fees, it would have taken two and a half years for them to cover the cost of the compensation and the penalties. And so since the decision was taken in 22, we would say they've been better off overall across that period of time. When you're in a situation where you say, well, this is nearly the biggest fine you could impose under the Act, the maximum fine that the judge could have imposed was $121 million. He imposed $90 million. Even then, in terms of savings, you could see that it could be perceived as a cost of doing business.
Professor of Labour Law at the University of Sydney, Shay McChrystal, speaking there with Maeve Groom.
Hi, I'm Ray Martin. You're listening to The Wire on community and Indigenous radio right across Australia. Stay well.
In late May, the New South Wales Mines government quashed the no-ground eviction process, which means landlords cannot evict a tenant with no reason. It was an election commitment the Mines government made when they entered government. Now the government has amended the Residential Tenancies Act and has added an additional reasonable grounds for eviction. One of them is called rent eviction. Thomas Kutis asked Professor Alan Morris, a sociologist and professor in the Institute for Public Policy and Governments at the University of Technology, Sydney, to explain a bit more about rent evictions.
Well, it's a word that's recently been developed to capture what has happened. So what happened
Thomas, is that no grounds evictions was scrapped in May 2025, and that was a major development. You know, historically, a landlord did not have to provide any reason for evicting a tenant in New South Wales, and this gave the landlord tremendous power. So the scrapping of no grounds eviction was greeted, you know, with much celebration. And new grounds for eviction were put in place. So one of the grounds was that a landlord could evict a tenant if they were going to make significant repairs or renovations to the premises. However, the landlord had to provide a written statement that this was going to happen, and also at least one accompanying piece of evidence, like a quote from a builder, a development application, etc. And for some reason, due to the property lobby being very powerful, that clause, that second clause that they provide evidence, was scrapped. So the argument is that this makes eviction a lot easier and also, in a sense, undermines the scrapping of the no grounds eviction.
So the New South Wales government back in late June created this loophole for this. Just expand a bit on it.
I mean, what they did was they just scrapped that that the landlord has to provide a piece of evidence besides a written statement. So what it does make it a lot easier for a landlord to, you know, a dishonest landlord just to claim that he's going to renovate. Of course, you know, to prove that he hasn't renovated will require a fair amount of surveillance. So then the landlord, so that once the tenant moves out, that's certain away, you know, and then the landlord might embark on renovations or they might not, you know, but by that time, of course, the tenant has moved out.
There have been problems where landlords have evicted a tenant for no reason and the tenant has breached the agreement by leaving the property early during the lease. Is this still a problem that's going on or has it calmed down lately?
So that's a difficult question. I think most, I mean, as far as I'm aware, you know, most tenants stay in the property as long as possible. Now, with the rental vacancy rate at around 1%, very, 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 very few tenants leave voluntarily because they know that if they leave, they would battle to find an alternative property, especially if they're low income. You know, if you're a low income renter and you lose your rental property, you could find yourself homeless. It's very difficult to access the rental property, especially if you're reliant on government benefits, for example. You know, landlords much prefer to have a tenant who's got, say, a significant income.
So what other shortcomings will come out of this?
Well, look, I think the other shortcoming, as we've noted, is the tribunal is still quite weak. There's not much discretion. So in other words, you know, if a tenant goes to the tribunal and appeals an eviction on the basis of a hardship, etc., as long as the landlord has followed the requirements, the legal requirements, it's very difficult for the tribunal to turn over the eviction order. Also, if the tenant is trying to prove that the termination was motivated by retaliation, that's a very difficult thing to prove.
Professor Alan Morris, sociologist and professor in the Institute for Public Policy and Governance at the University of Technology, Sydney, speaking there with Thomas Kutis. You're listening to The Wire, broadcasting all around Australia. And a big hello if you're listening to Edge Radio in Hobart, in 3BB Ballarat, where you can find Radio Gold, or in 8CC in the heart of the nation, Alice Springs. I'm Roderick Chambers. Soft plastic recycling is set to change in supermarkets once again. The ACCC has issued a new scheme proposing collection of soft plastic packaging from consumers for recycling purposes. The scheme will be run by Soft Plastics Stewardship Australia after the Red Cycle program's collapse in 2022 due to controversy over stockpiling plastics rather than recycling them. Food and grocery giants Woolworths, Coles, Aldi, Nestle, Mars, McCormick Foods, they're already on the board. They're already on board if the scheme is successfully implemented. Delaney Carter asked behavioural economist at the University of Tasmania, Robert Hoffman, what the scheme will do for all of the stakeholders involved.
So it's welcome news, I think, for everyone. We have a big problem with soft plastics. In between 22 and 23, about 500,000 tons of soft plastics were produced. That's the weight of 3 Sydney Harbour bridges. So that problem needs to be tackled, and those kinds of solutions, the one that the ACCC are proposing, are welcome. But there's also certain drawbacks. And from my perspective, the main drawback is that we need to change not just the recycling, but we need to change what individuals do, the behavior of individual consumers like you and me, when we go to Coles or Woolies or Aldi.
The scheme aims to collect and recycle soft plastic packaging from consumers, such as shopping bags and food wrappers. How will this impact consumers' shopping experience?
Well, in a simple sense, of course, it's going to make it less convenient. You and I and others, we are used to our daily conveniences. It's easy to go to the shop, take the packaging, throw it away. It seems clean, it seems hygienic. But unfortunately, we live in a world where we can't continue to behave like this indefinitely. Our planet is very finite. And basically, if we have to live less convenient lives in order to save our planet, I think that's a deal many people are willing to make. So maybe a little bit more inconvenience, but I think this is a problem we really need to tackle.
And could consumer choices such as buying more food without plastic packaging potentially save money, or will it make supermarkets even more expensive?
Well, that's a question you probably have to ask the supermarkets. I suspect there will be solutions. If consumer behavior changes across the board, I'm sure supermarkets will find ways, they will find economies of scale to stop their addiction to plastic wrappers and the like. But I can't speak to exactly what the cost base of supermarkets would be.
What are the potential effects the scheme can have for consumers?
Yeah, so there's a very paradoxical effect, which is called green moral hazard. I'll give you a simple example. If you go and you hire a car and you go for the cheapest insurance, you're going to be a very, very careful driver. But if you get the fully inclusive insurance, maybe you're going to take a little bit more risk. So basically what you think you can get away with is what you will try to get away with. If you take that idea and you translate it into this context of recycling, if you're a shopper and you're fully aware that there will be a very, very efficient recycling scheme operating behind the scenes, maybe you're not going to be quite as careful about reducing waste because you think the problem will be solved by technology. And the effect then might be that we don't actually end up changing our behavior because we think these policies are in place. And that sort of effect is not good because essentially at the end of the day, we have to change our behavior. There will come a point where we can't rely endlessly on technical solutions, technological solutions, legislation. We actually have to take a deep, hard look in the mirror and say, I need to change my behavior. And that's the downside of policies, as welcome as they are, policies.
Robert
like the
Hoffman, behavioral economist at the University of Tasmania, speaking there with Delaney Carter.
Hey there, I'm Hamish McDonald. Around Australia, you're listening to The Wire. Take it easy.
A trend known as T-maxing, or testosterone maxing, is gaining traction on social media with groups such as teenage boys most at risk. T-maxing is a practice that encourages individuals to recreationally take testosterone in order to achieve extreme physical goals. Taking testosterone is only medically advised when diagnosed with low testosterone and poses serious risks when taken unnecessarily. The practice threatens to exacerbate issues of body image faced by young people online. George Popel has this story.
What is the testosterone maxing trend?
So the testosterone maxing trend comes alongside a lot of these other maxing trends that you might have seen. such as fiber maxing, lux maxing, the sleep maxing. There's all a bunch of maxing trends, and they're all very social media savvy and driven trends, as you can tell by the name, really. But this particular trend is all about increasing your testosterone, whether by supposedly natural means or artificial means, sort of synthetic means, by taking exogenous testosterone. And that's the trend in a nutshell. It seems to be promoted by young men to other young men. And actually, in a lot of cases, from what I've seen online, these are often actually teenage boys, and they're sort of preying on the vulnerabilities of other teenage boys, really, who are wanting to look or be perceived as more masculine.
How are they sourcing testosterone?
Good question. I think in a lot of cases, they are not sourcing testosterone, and they probably wouldn't even really know where to start, because it's not always the easiest thing to procure, although I suppose if you really want to, you can. You can get products like this on, you know, the black market. You can get them in certain gyms where, you know, people, there might be someone who's able to supply products like this. But obviously, this is a listed medication, and you should only be taking or getting testosterone from a doctor under a prescription, because there are strict rules around its use and its prescription. Fundamentally, it's only supposed to be used for people that have clinically low testosterone, which is usually medically called hypogonadism.
What are some of the risks of taking testosterone when it is not medically needed?
It has very wide-ranging effects on the body, so disrupting it is quite risky. But the worst case scenario with taking testosterone when you really have no need for it is that your body can actually become quite dependent on it, because once you start taking exogenous testosterone, your body will shut down its own production of natural testosterone. And at that point, you can actually become lifelong dependent, which is not a great position to be in, especially if you had no medical need.
There are lots of clips online of influencers explaining the symptoms of low testosterone. Is this something that can be so easily self-diagnosed?
You cannot self-diagnose this. I mean, the only way to find out, so for certain, if you have low testosterone, is to get a blood test, you know, by a doctor, and the doctor can interpret the result. So yeah, you can't tell if someone's got low testosterone by looking at them, you know, or thinking, oh, you know, they don't have particularly big muscles, or they've not grown a beard, or things like that. It doesn't work like that. They might be high testosterone. There's really no way of telling, and there's no way of self-diagnosing that yourself. And any talk of an epidemic of low testosterone is total nonsense, because there's just really no way of knowing until people get a blood test. But, you know, a lot of these symptoms of having low testosterone could be any number of medical illnesses, to be honest.
How responsible is social media in encouraging young people to partake in these risky practices?
It's really complex, and I suppose fundamentally, social media is so disruptive to children or young people who are developing their identity and the sense of self. You know, living out your life on social media is a really tricky way to do that, I think, to grow up in that time frame. So we know social media has massive effects on not just how girls perceive their body and body image, but also bodies too.
What are some strategies that can be used to curb the influence of these unhealthy trends?
I think it's a really difficult time with social media influencers and the way the algorithms work. I mean, personally, I think it's a good step forward that we're implementing the social media age restrictions in this country eventually. Obviously, that'll come with its own tricky things to figure out, but I think it's generally a good thing. But other than that, you know, if you are concerned, for instance, about having low testosterone, the thing you need to do is go and speak to your doctor and get a blood test. But regarding, you know, the information that people see online from influencers, I just say to people, these people don't have your best interest in mind. Influencers, they don't care about you. So it's probably best to not listen to them. But, you know, it's easier said than done, isn't it?
Samuel Cornell, PhD candidate in public health and community medicine at the University of New South Wales, speaking there with George Popel. And that's it for The Wire today. You can find all of our stories online at thewire.org.au or subscribe to our podcasts. Just look for The Wire Radio. Today's program came from the studios of Radio 2 SER 107.3 here in Sydney and broadcast around the nation on the Community Radio Network. In Sydney, The Wire is produced on Gadigal country of the Eora Nation and with the assistance of the Community Broadcasting Foundation. We're going to be back again tomorrow, so do tune in again then. I'm Roderick Chambers. Do stay well, and thanks for your company.